This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
You're at 40 today.
We're at 40, huh?
Ooh.
Wow.
Podcast can officially start going through a midlife crisis.
See if we can get 40 by you two as our intro music this week.
I can put it in. I mean,
yeah, what are the chances they're going to listen?
I'm sure we won't get sued, probably. It'll be okay.
Hello, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
How's it going this week?
Well, now that I'm back to full time, Raphael decided to commemorate that occasion by assigning half of the unassigned pull requests to me. And when I agreed to this, I thought he meant, like, from the last couple of weeks. But no, he actually meant, like, unassigned opened in all time. So I've got 200 and some odd pull requests I'm going through.
I happened to be Googling about the various... the various no cache headers that you can set on a response. You can say like no cache, no store, max age equals zero, must revalidate, like a whole bunch of the headers that you can set. And to me, they seem redundant. And to what I was reading on the internet, like several of them are kind of redundant. And so I was like, I had this pull request on this client app I was doing, and I removed, I think it was no store, because no cache and max age zero was already set and private was already set. So I was like, I don't think you need no store as well. And basically what I was doing is I was trying to fall back to whatever the default Rails sets for all of the dynamic content you generate, right?
Yep.
And I was like, I don't want to have this before action that sets this no store thing. And somebody said that having no store there prevented the back button from serving a stale request, a stale response or whatever.
So it makes it so the back button always
refreshes.
Okay.
I don't know if that's actually specified anywhere, but I did confirm that in several posts dating from as far back as like 2008 up to like 2015, people say that doing this in various browsers has this effect. So I was like, well, let me see.
Did you try it?
I was like, no. let me see if Rails, you know, GitHub Rails has any issues about this. So I searched for it. And the reason why this story came up now was it was a kind of an old issue, and then I saw like in the last 5 or 6 days like assigned to Sean Griffin. I was like, yeah. Oh, I know that guy, and I know he probably has no idea what to do about this, so that'll be good.
Well, that's the thing that sucks about a lot of the really old ones too, is it's not just on none of these it's a binary just like, oh, I'm gonna merge this, or oh, I'm gonna close. I mean, sometimes it is just, oh, I'm gonna close this, but even if it's an easy decision to merge it, right, it has merge conflicts. And if the thing is good to merge other than fixing some merge conflicts and there's been no activity on it for, let's say, more than 2 weeks, I'm not going to ping the person and be like, hey, can you rebase this? Because by the time that they get around to rebasing it and then ping me that they rebased it, and then when I get around to seeing their ping, there'll be another merge conflict.
Exactly.
So at the very least, I'm having to manually merge all of these. But a lot of them, there's just so much time to get the context on the just to decide whether this is even a good fix or not. And then a lot of them actually do just need more work. And depending on the scope of it, right, if it's just, oh, this is missing some tests, or there's some style issues, or this belongs in a different file or something like that, like, and it's been inactive for months, I don't really want to close it or mark it as stale or something when it needs feedback. So on a lot of them, I'm also spending the time to go and actually finish the pull requests. And it's very slow getting through these, slower than I would hope.
Good luck.
Thanks. It'll be good to get rid of the backlog, though.
I want to pile some more stuff on your plate.
Okay, let's do it.
I have some problems with Active Record.
I'm probably your guy, then.
And it's API.
Okay.
So you seem like my guy. So I don't think... I was talking about this in ThoughtBot's Ruby chat room and Slack. In my years of experience with Rails, I don't think there's a single more commonly used, more screwed up API... like people get it wrong, then updating an existing record.
Okay.
because there are so many different ways that you can do it.
Yes.
Right. So you can call, like right now in Rails, you can call update. You can call update attributes, which
those are the same thing.
Those are the same thing, but you wouldn't necessarily know that, right? You can call update attribute. You can call update column.
Yep.
You can call update columns.
Can we just like group the singular and the plural versions together?
But you can't.
I agree. There's no reason to have the singular versions anymore.
Right. But well, update attribute and update attributes are very different.
That should not be the case.
Update attribute does not perform validations.
Hold on, I'm checking this. I'm almost positive the definition, the body of update attribute is just calling update attributes.
Update attribute singular does not call validations. It does everything else. I think it results in a save validate false. I'm just going by the documentation.
No, you're right. Why?
And so the documentation says it's useful for like setting Boolean flags, like saying, you know, I don't know, activated true, right? But the problem I repeatedly see on a lot of projects, and it's understandable why people make this because I have a hard time keeping it straight in my head, is they call update attribute because they only want to update a single attribute. So they're just, instead of passing like a hash of attributes, they're just passing two arguments, which is the name of the attribute they want to change and then the value they want to set it to. So the situation I found myself in was like there was one string of calls in an application that ended up calling update attribute like five times. And this is going to be five round trips to the database, right?
Right.
So I was like, okay, well, what I want then, I guess, is update attributes. And then I was like, oh, that's just update. And then I looked at the documentation and I was like, oh, no, that one skips validation. And so I had to sit there and think, like, I've got this legacy code that doesn't have great tests around it. They were previously calling update attribute five times. Were they doing that because they consciously wanted to avoid calling validations, or did they just get the API wrong? And my
Did they actually want to do five round trips to the database?
Right. I'm pretty certain, given the context, they didn't want to do five round trips to the database. It just happened that way. Like there were two in one method and then two more in the next method that gets called and another one somewhere else. So basically, I boiled those all down to change the object, right? Mutate the object in memory, call save validate false to skip the validations.
Yeah.
Thinking like at the very least, I have kept compatibility with any bugs that were there. Previously, right? So if this was done as a conscious decision, then great. If not, then, you know, I haven't fixed anything, but I also haven't hurt anything.
Right.
So that was like the first problem was like, okay, you can very, like you were confused as well that update attribute doesn't call validations, right?
Yep.
So there's this article, and we'll link to it in the show notes, that is like a matrix of the different ways you can write attributes and set them and update them in the database and the side effects that those have. Like whether or not it does an immediate write to the database, whether or not validations are called, whether or not callbacks are called, whether or not updated at gets set, whether or not it bothers checking to see if the thing, if the record is read-only, those types of things.
Yes.
So like, I just feel like it's an example of one of those APIs that kind of grew out of like somebody was like, oh, I want to do this. And people were like, yeah, okay, that seems reasonable. And then, but if you had to sit down and write an API for doing this, you'd be like, there's no way you'd end up here.
Well, I think a big issue with it and the reason that it ends up, like, I think given the state of everything else, I think this is not the problem. It's an indicator of the actual problem. But I don't necessarily think that the API for saving something is the problem. It's always going to be that messy because of the amount of implicit behavior we have to do all kinds of things that you don't always want to do.
Right. That's why, like, when I was thinking about this, I was like, I guess if I had to do this today, and I and it was a given that we needed validations, callbacks, updated at checks, like, we needed all to keep all this stuff, I think the only way I would have to opt out of that stuff is to call save with options, like we do today with save, validate, false, right? So you could say save, validate, false, callbacks, false, whatever.
Or we had a different object which was responsible for doing the actual persisting to the database, and the default object that you could get like as a method on application control or something would be the thing that has all of that behavior. And then if you didn't want all of that behavior, you just compose only a few pieces of it.
That's crazy talk.
It is crazy talk. No.
Yeah, that's good. The other time this bit me, so I forgot, there's one more thing that bit me about the update update API, is that update attribute, despite its name, can update several attributes.
Because it runs callbacks?
Not because it runs callbacks. I mean, yes, because it runs callbacks.
And then also because it's going through the setter.
Because it's, and because any mutations to the object that were in place before you called update attribute are right. also going to get written to the database.
Well, that's true of all of these, I think.
I think that's true. Update column, it's not true of.
Because that's going to go through update all.
Right.
That's exactly what it does.
So it's one of those things where, like, this chart doesn't actually have this as a column, but it could, right? Also saves mutations. And that would be another axis in which these differ. And I think that has surprised me in the past, where I've been like, oh, I didn't expect that to get written. And granted, the code wasn't the greatest, and it, you know, probably I probably could have been a lot more clear and only either mutated what I wanted to do and then call save, or done or used update attribute or update attributes appropriately. Right. But I'll be glad. I think it gets a little better when update attributes goes away and there's just update, which I think, is that happening in Rails 5? Is attributes, update attributes gone officially?
No, I don't think we've ever said that we were getting rid of them.
Because update was the thing that came in Rails 4, right? That is an alias for update attributes.
Let's see. That method was added, 2013. So, yeah, that would have been around Rails 4.
Right. So I was hoping that update attributes would go away in Rails 5, and then that would be like, you'd be left with update column, which pretty clearly to me says like you're doing this on the database, and then update attribute, which would be the weird thing that does everything except validations, and also if you happen to have mutated the object, those are also going to get written.
See, and that's part of why if it were up to me, I would get rid of the majority of these methods. Like if it were up to me, I would get rid of update and update attributes and update attribute singular in its entirety.
Right. And you would just have save?
And you just have save.
Right.
And that makes it a little bit less surprising that when you do attributes equals and then call save on it, makes it a little less surprising that other changes that were already there also get persisted. If right. you don't want to have validations, you don't run validations.
Right. You just pass validate false.
And I would also get rid of update column, the singular version, because if you look at the implementation, it just calls update columns for you. And I'm 99% certain that if you were to just write update columns with a hash, it would actually be fewer characters.
Right. So update column, I haven't looked at the documentation. I assume it takes two arguments, just like update attribute
name
does.
And value.
Right. And update columns takes a hash.
And then update column does what I had assumed and am surprised that update attribute doesn't do. Update column just calls update columns, creating a hash with a single pair.
Right. So anyway, that was like, and it's just so cool. It's one of those things that like we were chatting about this and we were like, is this the feature of Rails or Active Record that people get wrong the most? And other people thought like, oh, well, I actually have more problems with accepts nested attributes for, but like, you cannot use it. You can write an entire Rails app and never use accepts nested attributes for. You're going to call update in one of its forms all the time, basically.
I would say callbacks are the one that people get wrong the most.
What do you mean by that? Like just using them?
Just using them. But that's the thing. You may think, oh, I can build my entire app and never use callbacks. No, you can't.
No. If you use validations, you're using callbacks.
No, validations are not run as a callback.
That makes sense, actually, because, that does make sense because there's update attributes skips validations but not callbacks, so it can't be callbacks, right?
But things like updating associations, foreign keys, and dependent and stuff like that.
Oh, right, right.
Things like touch true. Right. Basically, anything related to associations gets implemented as a callback.
And then, like, it's a common to do, like, before validate is a pretty common thing to, like, ensure something's in the proper, like, you want to downcase an email or something like that.
Right. Which, like, I still don't understand why you wouldn't just overwrite the accessor or the writer.
Didn't you tell us not to do that?
Well, I was actually more referring to overwriting the reader. Overwriting the writer, no, that's especially if you're just doing something like calling dot downcase. I guess the main difference is if it matters whether or not dirty checking picks up like that the original value that was assigned was uppercased. Because if you were to do like def email equals super argument dot downcase, then dirty checking would always be comparing to the downcased version. It would have never seen the uppercase version.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you're fine with that,
right? I can't in the particular case of emails, I can't think of like what you're saying by calling downcase is like. Whether or not it's uppercase or lowercase, they're equivalent. I just want to store it in lowercase so I don't have to do a case insensitive match.
Right.
Basically.
And then if you do care about that with the attributes API, it would be pretty trivial to I kind of want to add like a map method to types. So that way, like if you just want to type that downcase, like this if you wanted the string type that downcases it, you'd do like type string dot map ampersand colon downcase.
Hmm. Yeah, do that.
I think the only question I would have is, like, which of the typecasting methods would that apply to? Or would I expect that to apply to? And then would I expect to have a contra map as well? And if I would expect to have a contra map, would I be willing to, would I be able to get anybody else to agree, on the Rails team anyway, to agree that contra map is in fact the correct name for the inverse of map?
Contra map.
Or the converse of map, sorry.
It sounds really cool.
So, like, if you had a library, for example, that was, like, responsible for encoding and decoding, and you had a codec type, which was responsible for both encoding and decoding, and if calling .map on it would change the behavior of the decoder half of it, contra map would change the behavior of the encoder.
Okay, sure. I would enjoy calling contra map on something. That's all I'm saying. It would remind me of the Konami code and all sorts of goodness.
Yes.
That's the end of my rant on update, I believe. That's all I've got for today, is that, I can't, it's one of those things that you can't change it. And at the same time, you can't blame the people that make the mistake, because you're like, yep, that's understandable. Yeah. I mean, I can say calling it five times in one action, it's probably that's a programmer error. Like, that should stand out to you as something that's five database round trips.
Yeah.
But the validation thing is definitely sneaky.
Yeah, but I also like a world where save is the only method for persistence.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe with a handful of exceptions, like, I think, well, create's an odd one. Create would make more sense to me if it could take an array. Like, create without a bang, specifically. Because
the class method create?
Yes.
Like user.create?
Yes.
Hmm.
Because it always, and if you don't have a bang, right, it always has to return something. And I'm almost positive in just about every app you can find somewhere where they're calling .create and not checking if the returned record was persisted.
Right.
And so then, like, it would silently fail to create the thing.
Because the contract of create, I mean, yes, the contract of create is it's always going to return you a, like, if it's user.create, it's always going to return you a user.
Correct.
Or raise an exception if something weird happened, I guess. But obviously.
Well, no, it won't raise an exception. Create bang would raise an exception.
Well, it could raise an exception if you did something absolutely insane, like, I don't know, not database related, right? But it's slightly different in that you may get back a persisted user, or you may get back an unpersisted user that has validation errors.
Right. Because if it failed to save, there's not a thing we can do to represent that it failed to save.
Right. Technically, those are two of the same types, I guess you would say. But, like, in reality, you're treating those two things entirely differently in your application.
Right.
But you don't get any indication based on the type that came back.
Well, normally, you know,
so what
right.
what would it taking an array do for you?
Batch insert.
Okay.
So doing a single query to create multiple records, which is, I think, a big hole in our API that I've been meaning to go fill for a while.
But then you would still be in a situation where then to check the result of all of those, you have to map over the array to check.
Well, yes and no. No, because we would run that operation
in a transaction?
Well, no, we wouldn't even need to run it in a transaction. It's a single query. If any of them failed to save, they all failed to save.
Okay.
I mean, really, what we need is a result type here.
Yeah, yep.
And also separating out, like, client-side validation from database-level validation, where a database-level validation is this, like, because unique indexes are the only one where it's, like, you can't actually validate this ahead of time. Everything else, it's the sort of thing where the database validation would be there to verify integrity, and you don't necessarily ever need to handle it other than treating it the same as your database being completely down, as in, like, you return a 500 or something non-recoverable, except unique index failures are that one case where it's like, maybe you really do care about that, and maybe it is actually recoverable. Anyway, my point being...
Hang on, wait, explain to me what you mean. Like, so unique indexes is the only validation for which you
database
could...
Database level.
Database level validation for which you could have, like, you can have an active record validation that says uniqueness of, and you could have the equivalent database constraint, and they can disagree, right? And that's because of concurrency and all that craziness.
I mean, technically, all of them can disagree because of concurrency, but...
Right, well, null false is not going to disagree. Like, it's either null or it's not. It has nothing to do with
true
concurrency.
Yeah. That's true. And, actually,
and you can write,
right.
You can write all sorts of custom constraints that probably would have this same... thing, right? But barring those
anyway, right? And so in my mind, application facing validations don't belong on the model at all, because ultimately creating a model isn't a function that returns a model or that takes attributes and returns a model. It's a function that takes attributes and either returns a model or a series of errors.
Right. But that's not what it does today. It always returns a model. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
In some other ORMs. That's
we talked a little bit about this in our episode. Right from memory, I'm going to say it's 11. Hopefully I'm right about that one. We'll link it in the show notes. We talked about it we were talking about form objects, and we said like we'd both kind of love to experiment with the idea of like not doing active record validations on active record objects, and instead having form objects for everything that added the validations you needed, and then letting the database handle the database integrity type stuff.
Right. And then theoretically, right, you should never be passing data that would violate database integrity. So you can treat database integrity failure as an unrecoverable, should never happen kind of error, same as the database being down or any generic database operation did not work kind of error. But then uniqueness kind of just muddles all of that up.
I guess. I mean, the adapters could conceivably inspect the error message they're getting back from the database and say that this is a uniqueness.
I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying that sort of ideological argument stops working because of uniqueness.
Well, I mean, it doesn't necessarily stop working. Like the times where, I don't know, maybe it's just I'm not working on big enough apps. Like the times where these things rear their heads are like double clicks and double submits,
right?
Things like that. And those cases, like, weird stuff happens, right? And you can try and prevent double submits by using disable, or I guess you're not gonna have to do that. Didn't somebody do that for us? We talked about that.
Yep.
Right, that's
yep.
Now gonna be default. So like double submits go away. Like it's kind of an edge. You can kind of relegate it to edge cases, I think.
Right.
And hope.
No, and most of the time that you would have a uniqueness validation or a unique constraint in the database, I would say that let's say 75% of those aren't something the user could recover from anyway, because they're not things that the user has control over. They're things like making sure a has one is actually a has one, but you're doing it implicitly under the hood or stuff like that. Yeah. And like I think for most apps, the only place where it would be a user recoverable error is sign up. And then I think, I mean, definitely you still need the unique constraint in the database, but I think at that point, then the Rails style uniqueness validation is sufficient. And if two users really do try and sign up with the exact same email at the exact same time, and one of them sees an error instead of like a 500 instead of a form error,
right,
like you're one in a billion. Like, so what?
Right. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I definitely think most uniqueness validations, and it's hard actually when you start adding the uniqueness validations, because then you're like, when one of those comes up, you're like, oh, well, this didn't get displayed because the field that the error is on isn't actually in the form. So what happens is the form just re-renders, right?
Right. Well, there ain't
shit you can do about it.
Yeah, well, that's sort of right. That's why the old Rails style of error still exists, even though nobody uses it, but where you have all of the errors at the top instead of the errors on the inputs individually.
Right, yeah. I generally will do, like, I'll read off base or something like that.
Right, but if it's on a field, then base wouldn't get populated.
Does that thing still exist? The one that did like the error message formatting in a list? I don't think it does anymore. I think they got rid of
it. It was never a thing in Rails. It's just a thing the scaffold generates.
Okay, all right.
And yes, it still exists.
If you use the scaffold, you would see that, I guess.
Anyway, I mean, none of this is immediately actionable. It's just this idea. I mean, this is just harkening back to the whole issue with update. I think we just have too many things muddled together. And it makes it really, really hard to actually reason about what any of it is doing.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where Rails is at the age and at the size and at the usage amount that, like, that ship has sailed and it's not it's not coming back. These update methods are going to exist, and some of them might change. Like, I could conceivably see update column becoming defined in terms of update columns at some point in a major change that's a breaking change or whatever. Like, that's a relatively minor breaking change.
I just move them all into a gem.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that actually seems to be a reasonable thing that has been happening a lot with Rails, is like protected attributes got moved out to a gem, responders got moved out to a gem, all this stuff that people wanted to deprecate got moved out into gems.
Right. Yeah, and that's the sort of thing, right, is that I can deprecate it. Kind of. And then if somebody, you know, I mean, that one, I would probably just maintain that gem till the end of time and not actually deprecate it. But I'm more thinking of, like, what's the equivalent of me making a breaking change but having it only affect newly generated apps? And I think that's the closest. That would be where I can, like, remove it from Rails except for existing apps.
Right. And that, like, some gems do this by generating a configuration. So like when you run your new configuration, you get opted in automatically to all of these breaking change, what otherwise would have been breaking changes.
Right, and it's like, I'm not going to have config.has these methods equals true.
Right. Config.can update single column true.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, then it becomes a question, right? So does update columns? I mean, if I go through them, I guess update column, or is it update columns? Which one calls update all under the hood? It is update columns, yeah. So maybe update columns, that's a reason to stick around. But like, I think that's the only one. I would rather get rid of update column, update attributes bang, update bang, update attributes, update without a bang, update, and update attribute singular, all of those in favor of attributes equals and calling save. And if you do not want to run validations, passing validate false to save.
Right. And that the only downside to that I can see, other than, you know, it breaks people's apps unless they put in these gems or something like that, would be that you can no longer do an update in a controller in a single step, right? You got to find your user, which you always had to do, and then you've got to do user.attributes equals and assign the attributes, then call save rather than update and pass a hash.
Yep.
Seems fine.
I don't think that's that big of a deal, especially because, like you said, right, when your controller becomes more than one line long, which most are, there's a lot of other implicit behavior that comes as a result of that being one line. And while it may like look, oh my god, I've made this so much worse in the scaffold style controller actions rarely remain that short for very long.
Right. Okay, so I should expect a pull request that has like active record, a new gem that's like active record deprecated persistence.
I probably wouldn't put deprecated in the name because putting deprecated in the name implies that we're gonna stop supporting it.
Well, active record deprecated finders.
Right, which we dropped support for in Rails 5.
Oh, all right.
But I would definitely put it in a gem like, yeah, active record for persistence or something like that. I don't know. I'm going to think about it some more and bring it up with some other folks and see what they think. And then maybe Rails 5 would be the version to do that.
Yeah, let's shovel it all into Rails 5 because you're not going to get another shot for another year and a half.
Yep.
So
pretty much.
As we talked about in our last episode with Yehuda.
Yeah.
So you're on full time on Rails now?
Yes.
Does that mean you're full time with Shopify now?
Yes.
Congratulations. How's that going?
Good ish. I've been trying to get the test suite to run. It fails a bunch and then seg faults.
Seg faults?
Yes. Which apparently that one was not my fault because CI was also seg faulting, but apparently that's now been fixed and it's still seg faulting and failing for me. And it takes like over 4 hours, which sucks because I'm hoping to contribute to helping get us onto Rails 5, specifically by removing our uses of add or accessible. But I figure the way to do that is to remove a call to add or accessible and run the test suite. This has proved to be a greater challenge than I expected it to be. So yeah, that's been... And then I get frustrated and just go work on these pull requests.
Right. So that is so. How is your job going to work at Shopify? Because you are full time on Rails, but clearly you're trying to get the Shopify test suite to run. Is that kind of like you need to get get Shopify running to see how the changes that you're going to be working on for both Rails and for Shopify, like on Rails for Shopify?
Well, I mean that's part of the that's part of the benefit for them, right? Is that I'm able to do things like help get them on master, and I benefit greatly from them being on master because it gives me another vector of information for performance changes and bug fixes and stuff like that. And like even yesterday, I got pinged on an issue where something wasn't working as expected. I mean it was using the attributes API in Rails 4.2, so technically like. Whatever, it may not work as expected because it's private API in 4.2, but it was for a thing that I was almost positive wasn't that way. And you know, in my head, I'm like, can we just? It would be really really awesome if we could just check this against master, but we can't right now because we have not finished migrating to Rails 5. And I would like us to migrate to Rails 5 in a short enough span of time that like it's within striking distance Rails 5 being released. So that way when we've migrated to Rails 5, we've actually migrated to master and we can just start tracking master like perpetually and run CI against master on a nightly basis or something and have it be you flip a switch if you want to try it, you know, and then if this guy's doing this thing, I'm like, can you see how that works on master? They just flip a switch and run the test.
and being at a place where you're going to be like, you're going to be there for a while, so you can set up infrastructure like that, and you can set up infrastructure to run performance tests. You can set up all this different stuff to test all the types of things that you're working on,
right?
And have time to actually reap the rewards from that. So that's pretty cool.
Exactly. And it's the same sort of situation I had in the past at Thoughtbot for a while as well, where I'm spending, you know, I spend a good chunk of my time just in Slack helping other developers with issues, which we have a lot of junior developers, so there's a lot more of those.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, being available to help people out, which I love doing, like just spending an hour helping somebody else solve a problem.
Right. And they're lucky to have access to the person who has written a good chunk of the of Active Record at this point. And certain,
yes.
And certainly has seen just about every corner of it. So that's cool. I still definitely use the fact that you hang out in our Slack for that purpose.
Which is fine. It's good. No, it's like I actually really do like it when people, you know, give me more visibility into what's happening with everybody else using Rails, as long as it's done in a context where, like, sorry, tough luck is an acceptable answer for me to give. Like, I always really do love having those kinds of conversations and seeing what problems people are having, even if it is just something that might not be immediately actionable, like the update thing.
Right. Well, we just determined how it's going to be immediately actionable.
Maybe, yeah.
You write that gem anyway, and then I'll write another gem if it doesn't get pushed into Rails anyway. I'll write another gem whose sole job it is to remove those methods.
Yeah, it just calls undef method.
Right.
Yep.
And then you can layer those two gems together, and you know.
And then I'll sneak it into the default gem file.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
What else? Anything else?
Oh, hold on. No, okay. You were right. You called it.
Wait, say it again.
You were right, Derek.
Okay, what did I call?
So we switched over to Basecamp 3 recently, and Rails 5 was added to the Basecamp 3 calendar for December.
Ah!
And in the episode that is about to go out as of this recording, in that you said, and you say August, I say Christmas. So you were right, Derek.
It's just like it's a track record of major Rails releases. It's about 6 months after they say they want to get the betas out that they come out.
Well, usually, like for 4.2, we released like actual 4.2 in December, but we had a very long beta and RC cycle that lasted, I think, 2 or 3 months.
Right. That'd be fine. I'm not like it's unfortunate. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. Like every time I have to write or as a string in a inside where, I'm like, oh man, like really like to just be able to use or. Yeah. Yep. So it's unfortunate that it happened like that. And it would be cool to release more often in smaller releases. But
yeah, it's a discussion. I've got just so many things. I'm behind on a lot of things. And I'm just trying to get caught up on all of the things.
Mm-hmm.
And having that discussion is definitely, I guess I'm not behind on that, because I did say I was going to wait till after we release 5 to really start having that discussion. So
yeah, I mean, I think there's a thesis behind like the various things that could have been immediately helpful to people on 4x that there was no reason not to release on 4x other than what
you get all the other stuff in master,
right? So yeah, it's kind of, it just seems like marketing, and it's kind of unfortunate this point. But
well, and you know what, I think that might still be fine, because I feel like in Basecamp's mind, like the big features are Action Cable and Turbolinks 5. Mm-hmm. Actually, and since both of those were developed at Basecamp, like the rest of the framework being on a shorter release cycle might not be that big of an issue.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/40.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any other episode, you can tweet to us @_bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the comments on the website.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
Bring, bring.